Today we're going to talk about how not to fall into wokeism and cancel culture, or the spirit of cancel culture. Listen, are the problems in Western civilization real? Yes. Are the problems in the history of the church? You better believe it. Is racism a very real problem in American history and its present? Of course. Is systemic racism real? Actually, yes, I think it is. You know what else is a very real problem? The tendency that people have today to reduce all of the history of Western civilization, American history, the history of the church, to nothing but its worst elements. The ways that the, quote, patriarchy has been misused and abused the opposite sex. The bigotry, the hatred, the racism. And to see that all the beauty of all Western civilization, the church history, everything can be reduced to nothing but those worst elements. And there's young people who go to college today and actually are trained to see all that their grandparents and parents handed on to them as nothing but that. And their natural conclusion is, hey, let's burn the whole thing down. Hey, here's another idea. Let's not burn the whole thing down. So we're going to help you dive into the whole woke ideology, which I prefer to call nothing but-ism, the reduction of all this beauty to nothing but its worst elements, and help you dismantle it, understand where people are coming from, and respond with the right spirit, not falling into a spirit of cancel culture yourself, where you maybe are looking for woke ideology everywhere, which is exactly as bad as people who are woke looking for the systemic injustice everywhere. It's all a craziness that's just ripping us apart as a society, and Jesus is calling us to more. So, although this episode might feel a little more culture war-ish or philosophical, sometimes, guys, we got to go there in order to just clear the ground and be able to talk to each other and share the gospel again. And this is one of those times. Now, if you really want to solve the problems in Western civilization, well, that starts with solving problems in your own heart, in your own marriage. So before we dive into this topic, I got to give a plug to this. Go to reallifecatholic.com/marriage or follow the link in the show notes. We're releasing an amazing program April 1st. You can pre-sign up for this. It's only available for 3 months for free, and it's going to change your marriage. It's simple. It's digestible. It's life-changing, and I want you to take that link and share it with everybody you know. Now, let's dive into our interview with Noelle Meering, the author of Awake, Not Woke. And please like, subscribe, share this with everybody you know. And if you disagree with half the things that I say in this interview or half the things Noelle says, guess what? I love you anyway. Please leave those disagreements in the comments. I'll jump in and I'll dialogue with you. Thanks for watching. Noelle Meering, thank you so much for making time to be here. You got 6 kids.
I have 6 kids, just like you.
Yes.
Yeah.
The few, the proud, the people crazy enough to have 6 kids. Only you have 6 kids in LA, so it's even crazier.
It is a little crazier. But we're not quite in LA, so that helps.
Well, let's lean into the crazy and let's get ourselves canceled during this episode. Because I know it's really popular to dismantle wokeism, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if there's anything I've spoken about, and I don't obsess on this. From our ministry, it's probably like 1% of the time talking about controversial issues if I see them as an obstacle to my primary mission, which is preaching the gospel and spreading the joy of God. But you dive into that 1% and people blow that up, latch onto it. It's like, no, this is all he ever talks about now. It's like, not really.
Right.
But it's really important to go here. So let's define our terms. And thanks for your book on this topic.
Sure.
I'm sorry, before we dive into this, how did you get the time to write a book with 6 kids running around your house?
Well, theoretically, it should have been easy because I have 6 kids, but the youngest, I think when I wrote the book, was maybe 8. And they were all in school, a sweet little Catholic school in our town. I signed contracts, got my research books together, sat down to write it. 2 weeks later, everyone comes home because of the quarantine. And we had one computer. I was sharing, they were all homeschooling on the computer.
Were you writing at like 2 a.m. every day?
No, I just didn't homeschool them. I asked one of my older sons to homeschool the little kids.
You unschooled, pretend it was intentional.
Yeah, I did school them, it was unschooling. yeah, so I thought, we don't do computer. I gave them books and said,
awesome.
You're on your own, I need to write a book.
Well, it's beautiful. Awake, not woke, gotta get it. All right, let's define our terms. What's woke? What's wokeism? And this is hard to define.
It is.
It's like trying to grab the tentacle of, like, there's so many things that go into this, a cultural trend. And people who really espouse it in a hardcore way don't want you to define it.
That's right.
They kind of take that away because that's an advantage you have if you can put a word on it. So what's wokeism?
Yeah, I think it really thrives being left ambiguous, right, or left up to interpretation. And in some ways, I mean, how you define it kind of captures where you are in the debate. So you might say it's a movement for compassion. This is an effort to, as Christ would have, encourage people to walk alongside with the marginalized, the oppressed, and to support them. And I think that there is an element of that in it, and that's what really pulls a lot of people of goodwill into the movement. But ultimately, fundamentally, I think it is a revolution on multiple levels. I think it's a cultural revolution. I think it's a political revolution. And I think, most importantly, it's a revolution against human nature and against God and his authority to establish a moral law. And so that's really what motivated me to write the book. It wasn't really the political element of it. It was that we are redefining really everything. What it means to be human. Yeah, everything. But starting with very basic foundational things. And once you sort of seed foundational lies in that realm, you end up with a whole sort set of distortions and people really not able to flourish. Also, you end up with needing to control the narrative, right? Because lies don't stand up to scrutiny. And so you wind up with censorship, with a lot of top-down efforts at control, with a lot of real kind of manipulative tactics in order to maintain a woke narrative.
So that was 45,000 feet. Yeah. Let's come down to 35,000, right? Because that's good to have the bird's eye view. There's this dismantling of all things, including how we see human nature, right? Philosophically, where did this emerge? Where did this come from? If you could trace it and spell that out for us.
Yeah, it's kind of a convergence of multiple streams of thought. I mean, the most common one that people would point to would be Karl Marx, who was hugely influenced by Hegel. But then you also come into postmodernism, Nietzsche, various, like the structuralism, the manipulation of language. All of these iterations sort of combine and converge at some point to form sort of a powder keg of ideology. But I think foundationally that Marxist understanding that we are defined into division. And so when I think at the foundational...
So it's how he saw life.
This is how
people
he saw
life. Are defined in terms of class distinction and class division.
That's right. Fundamental divisions, and that drawing out those conflicts is how you establish, go through the progression of history into some future utopia, is by bringing out that conflict. But so I think the main, one of the biggest shifts was that we traditionally have always defined people in ways that unite us. We are rational animals, so we have a common ability to think together, we can discuss, we can debate, we have the ability to reason, we're distinct from the beasts. And then as Christians, we know that we're defined the image of God. We're invited into a family type of relationship, to be brothers and sisters, sons and daughters of a loving God. And the woke movement really changes that utterly on its head and says, we're not defined by the love of God, but by the hatred of society. And so that oppression gets to the core of who you are. So I think about this even...
So it's not something that humanity has and deals with. It is humanity. It is the defining factor in the course of human history. In our nature as rational beings, that it's all defined in terms of the distinction of class division and the battle for justice.
Right, and it comes not just on the lines of class, but it spreads, one of the things that they realized, revolutionaries, was that it can't just be on the level of class and economics. It had to spread into sex, into race, into all other categories. You had to broaden the opportunities to redefine people into division. And one of the consequences is that it eliminates the ability to think together, right? We can't really reason together. That the chasm becomes so foundational that it's unbridgeable. I can't actually reach across it. So there's no real avenue for a real friendship, for a real discussion. It just becomes reducible to identity utterly. And I think there's a real violence that's seeded into societies that sort of devolve into that kind of real toxic sort of tribalism.
And we really start to celebrate violence. But before we go there, we could see society heading in that direction, and it's scary. The whole woke ideology appeals to something good in people. And frankly, this is the irony of ironies. It appeals to something that we wouldn't have as a society to appeal to were it not for Christianity.
That's right.
Even though wokeism would tend to redefine Christianity by reducing it to nothing but a colonialist, bigoted organization that's a divisive and harmful force in the world. And kids come home from college and their grandparents are like, wait, you suddenly hate everything I raised you with? Like, why, right? So despite the fact that wokeism would reduce Christianity to that, were it not for Christianity appealing to the dignity of the human being, it wouldn't have even taken root. Like, if we were still Rome, the Roman Empire, 2023, you think there'd be anybody that could get away with a woke idea?
Right.
Come on, we'll just smash you. You want to rise up and claim justice, causes, whatever. No, it's all about the emperor and his power. So what is it that this is appealing to that's good and real?
Well, I think that there's a way in which that's by design, that really, I think it shapeshifts this ideology, because I do think that is animated ultimately from a power that is not of this world, you know, a dark power. And I think it realizes that, you know, as a Christian nation with those roots and that heritage, that we really are going to be taken in by a movement that is orienting itself around an appeal to compassion. That is really gets to the heart of what is going to be compelling for us. Because, you know, as Christians, compassion is not just something on the surface of what we believe. It's at the very heart of it, right? That we believe that love is who God is, and so that's who we are called to be.
And that the oppressed should be liberated.
And that they should be liberated, and that we should be people who walk alongside them. And so, you know, I understand why so many people are compelled by it. It's really hard to say, okay, this movement is claiming that whole territory of compassion, and if you're not implementing your compassion in this particular way and applying it in this particular way, you're on the side actually of hatred. And that sort of divisive binary where it's either you're with us in totality or you're on the side of hatred.
So you're saying we need to be non-binary.
We need to be non-binary. That's right.
Sorry.
It's a bad binary.
It is, right?
Yeah.
It's this kindergarten assessment of history. That's just, it's black and white, good guys, bad guys, and pick the right side.
Yeah. But you can see why it's compelling, because people have a fundamental need to belong. And so when someone says, okay, you have to belong to this movement of compassion or else you are ostracized. Well, that's a real human fear of being cast aside and not belonging. So I think it's really preyed on that very basic human need and has been very successful in that way.
You know what's maybe even scarier? It seems to be a human need to identify an enemy.
That's right.
You know, there's psychological tests that have been done that show people actually find emotional comfort in identifying an enemy because it takes all the attention off of themselves.
That's right.
Saying, that's my enemy, I'll destroy that enemy. And it doesn't take much thought to see how that can go in the wrong direction. But every movement that has become a bloody massacre appealed to actual good things. Like the French Revolution, fraternity, equity,
Liberty.
Yeah, right. Who doesn't want those things?
Right. Well, lies are only compelling if they have a grain of truth, right?
Yeah.
But it's interesting. I mean, what you were saying about that desire to find an enemy. I mean, I really think that that's very captivating because all of us want to deflect from our responsibility. And so once you kind of create a moral incentive to find your moral stature and the ability to claim a victim identity, you have to become a perpetual accuser. There's no such thing as a perpetual victim without someone to accuse. And so it incentivizes us to find evil outside of ourselves at all times and to never really be able to identify it within. It's really contrary to the faith, right? The faith is constantly like knowing, recognizing that's a human tendency, temptation. And so it's saying, okay, do an examination of conscience. Okay, go to confession. Do a mea culpa.
Yeah.
You know, look at yourself. Look at the sins in your own soul. Look at the pollution that pervades your own mindset and heart and deal with that, you know. And that's the road to harmony. And, you know, the family helps us with that. You know, family life, you're constantly being held a mirror to your own sins, your own faults, your own failures. You're seeing your selfishness because your kids start mimicking selfishness.
I thought I was a saint until I had kids. But there's also the gospel command of and I, by the way, I love the title of your book, Awake Not Woke, because you're not saying don't respond to injustice, but do it in the Christian way, do it in a better way.
That's right.
And you see that better way in people like the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., like the Reverend, like his worldview in approaching everything was shaped by this idea that you should love your enemies, that there is injustice and we are going to work on it, but not from the spirit of I'm going to get even, I'm going to rip everything down, I'm going to burn society to the ground so that we can start over. That's a profoundly different worldview that animates activity from the same motive, which is I want to set things right.
That's right.
Oh, isn't that scary? I mean, one's driven by the Holy Spirit. I think one is clearly driven by a dark spirit, and the fruits are evident.
That's right. Yeah, and you know, I think that beyond that, that redefinition to victimhood and accuser, which, you know, I think we know who the accuser is, you know, the father of lies is the accuser. And I think that, that it's not an accident that we're trying to be redefine ourselves as into that sort of characteristic. But also, I think it's telling us that we are not only oppressed by other people, but oppressed by the moral law itself. You know, and that's a very stark distinction from Martin Luther King Jr., who also wrote about the natural law and the letter from the Birmingham jail. The total abandonment of any sense of natural law finally makes God our oppressor as the author of the natural law. So that's another, you know, I think that the way that that trains people to sort of try to triumph and free themselves from natural law is to transgress it. And so it gives us a second identity where our liberty is grounded in our transgression, which is another alarming and harmful. Yeah,
right, incident. It's hidden in plain sight.
Yeah.
I mean, I think of the organization Black Lives Matter. You look at their website, and yeah, it's great. You want racial justice, and then three lines down is part of the mission statement to dismantle the nuclear family. Right. I remember when all this stuff was starting to break. And I saw that. I'm like, wait, what's the connection? Well, people who understand the worldview that underlies where some people approach justice from can see the connection clear as day.
That's right.
Like, let's dismantle everything. But another place where this comes from, and I think it's been fueled, legitimately fueled, is the reality of systemic injustice, right? One unfortunate thing, I made a video on wokeism a while ago, and I hate this, that some people would, without really diving into where this comes from, what it is, understanding it, we hear the word wokeism, get a basic understanding of it, and then be dismissive of every claim of injustice.
That's right.
Right? And just say, oh, it's just woke. Like, no, actually, there's racism.
Yeah.
And it's really bad.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's more than just one guy hating another. It's becomes the lived experience, right? For someone who doesn't know how to grasp that, think of, maybe this would be easier to latch onto, lust. Lust can be systemic in society. Kids go to school. They're told they have to have a computer. Mm-hmm. You can't be on a computer for more than 5 minutes without having to have the willpower to click away from an invitation to look at porn. Mm-hmm. So based on the whole way they grow up, they're drawn to this. So it's happened in places in history where racism could have the same expression. Since that's a reality, wouldn't the woke culture warrior say, well, therefore, shouldn't I wake up to it and look for it everywhere and make my life about dismantling it? Mm-hmm. How would you respond to that?
Well, I think that we have to be careful when we recognize that there's a real injustice, that we are not in the application of the solution becoming excessive. And I think that there are so many ways in which we have ignored the excesses of the movement. So, for example, you can't respond to racial injustice with chants like defund the police or just, you know, break down society in that way. You can't respond to the Me Too movement with believe all women. It's nonsensical. You can't just assume that just because someone is born a woman that they cannot lie. You know, that doesn't make any sense. Or smash the patriarchy, right? You know, these are all toxic ways of responding to real injustice. So I think that we have to be cognizant of those sort of excesses. And also looking at, okay, what are the effects of if I say that there's such systemic injustice that any disparity between any sort of group of people is only attributable to a systemic injustice? Mm. That absolves me of any responsibility.
Wow.
If all my successes and my failures are because of maybe, I don't know, my skin color, because I'm a man, or because I'm able-bodied, or what have you, then that means that I can't really learn from my failures, nor can other people, can I inspire someone or be humbled and grateful for my successes. So I think it's really a matter of despair at that point, that people don't find that they can have any meaningful ability to change anything in their daily life. They have to blow things up. It's the system that's the problem.
It also excuses me from actually working on myself when it comes to virtue and vice.
That's right.
Right? The woke version of virtue is like this Gnosticism. I come to a knowledge, therefore I spiritually wake up and I'm better than everybody else. Even if that's, I don't do a dang thing with it, except, I don't know, flaunt how much more I know than you on social media.
That's absolutely what it is. And the irony too is that the movement tends to ignore the one systemic change you can make in society, that if you could wave a magic wand and improve everyone's life, fathers in the home. Mm. Well, me, yeah, you change yourself.
Well, you change yourself, repent of sin.
But if you're talking about a social pathologies, intact families would make the greatest difference.
Oh my gosh.
In society. It's not make everyone one skin color or make everyone a man or whatever have you. It's for the family. And the family's a total target of revolution.
It's scary, isn't it? Well, it's a hatred of the father.
It is a hatred of the father.
Every revolutionary is based on that hatred of the father.
Yeah.
That's just satanic.
It's satanic. And, you know, one of the connections there is that once you target the father, if you target the shepherd because you want access to the sheep. So there's a real connection between taking out the fathers and having access to the innocence of children. And this is one of the darker parts of it. But if you read, you know, unfortunately, I've had to spend a lot of time reading the queer theory and all this gender ideology. It's really, there's a real targeting of children, of innocence, because innocence stands, innocence points us to a measure. It points us to a standard, and it forces us to look at ourselves, right? And so we're seeing this pattern here where we're trying to avoid looking at ourselves. And so the innocence of the child, innocence of, you know, alternative sexualities and all these things, is really, they have to be disabused of that innocence in order to perpetuate this idea that there is no particular way of being in the world, that our sexuality is really anything that we choose for it to be. And so I think this really explains why, you know, we're seeing so much targeted at children with the drag queen stuff and the gender ideology in schools from the earliest ages. This is really, it's part of the revolution. It makes sense according to the logic of the revolution.
It's also, the revolution is also based on, again, that binary good guy, bad guy view of history. To just try to want to demonize one group, redeem another group. The demonized group is usually the group that comes from the European world. And the, again, the response is, this is not just the woke folks, but the people who are a lot of conservatives, it's just binary. Like, no, it was all good.
Right.
You know, a great story that sums up the mixed bag of it all, I think of the Maori people. And they had a tradition of prophecy. And there was one prophet, and it was all well recorded, that this guy, before white people came to New Zealand, he had vivid dreams and visions of people coming in a boat. He was acting out what it looked like when they smoked their pipes. Really beautiful. He said, their God will be good, and their God's name is the son that was killed. I get chills thinking about it. So the Lord is preparing the way for the gospel through the prophetic gifts of that he was giving them before they heard of the gospel. And he said, but the people will still be oppressed. It was that mixed reality. And the Maori people had a lot of violence. There was tribal warfare. There was cannibalism. And those things came to an end. There was real peace. And at the same time, there was real oppression and the trauma of colonialism. All these things together. But now we're hundreds of years later. And there's a reckoning that people want based on things that happened hundreds of years ago. But like the only, if we're going to hold on to, like, instead of moving on and trying to fix things now, like I thought the thing that Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. wanted to do, like Jesus would call us to do. I mean, it would be like me going back to Ireland and saying, you deprived my people of land 150 years ago during the potato famine. Let's burn down London.
Right.
I mean, where is this leading? I mean, let's talk about that a little more. This is clearly leading to a violence that's irrational based on things that happened long ago or things that are happening now, but when the solution is let's burn it all down. I dug this up from one of your articles, this quote from Sartre. You found a gem here where he's a French deconstructionist philosopher, which is, I think, the root of a lot of where the woke thinking comes from. When his rage boils over, man rediscovers his lost innocence. And he comes to know himself in that he himself creates his self.
Which is so scary.
It not only sounds satanic, it's also deeply Marxist.
And
so that was in the preface of The Wretched of the Earth, a book about decolonization.
Talk about the whole, because again, I'm dropping this in 30 seconds, summing up a little bit of this, but talk about decolonization, where this will lead. Because this is not just theoretical and academic. There's kids come home from college and their grandparents are stunned. Like, wait, you think all of the history of Western civilization is nothing but evil and you don't like me anymore? You won't go to church with me anymore? Why?
Yeah.
Because it's something you're learning in history class or every class? Yeah, define decolonization and where it's showing its teeth.
Well, I mean, there's a narrow way to define it, which is obviously colonial, breaking free of the oppression of a colonized nation. But the thing that's important to understand is that the woke movement has transferred that into all of America, that they have slogans like decolonize everything. Harvard had a podcast called, now I'm forgetting the name of it, but it was something to that effect too, that everything is colonized. We decolonize it all, that the school curriculum is colonized, that everything,
But 2 + 2 = 4 is an example of colonization.
That's
how?
Right.
How is that?
Well, 2 + 2 = 4. I think the idea that there is any sort of objective truth at all.
Is an example of colonization.
It's example of colonization.
Isn't that crazy? As if indigenous people didn't have the concept of truth? Come on, it's an offense to indigenous people.
It's an offense to, that's exactly right. It's offensive to everyone.
Yeah.
And it's not empowering to anyone. But I think that Sartre quote really points to the idea that if you can establish that we are colonized in America, you have a right to violence. In fact, you have a duty to violence. That one of the things he talks about is how when you kill a colonizer, you're killing two people. You're killing the one who oppresses you, but you're also killing the non-person that you were before, the inhuman person that you were as a colonized peasant.
Who
and that's how you
awake.
Create yourself. Mm. And that's how you become free. But it's also this sort of self-creation thing that is common through Marx and also, a very occult idea. So violence really is at the core of it, because the idea is that the colonized system is itself violence, that you're living under violence, and so you have a right to respond to violence. So one of the things that happens is that what is morally licit is not based on principle, but on identity. And so again, we no longer can reason together, because there's no common principle that applies to all of us, to which we are all subject, and that also that contains the contents and contours of our flourishing. There is only identity, and based on who you are, that determines what is okay for you to do.
And in that context, speech is violence, and violence is speech.
That's right.
It's an acceptable form of speech, which it's so disturbing to see that become more and more common.
That's right.
If you were to go on a lot of college campuses, you drive 4 hours north of Berkeley and give a talk about wokeism, you'd physically be in danger.
That's right.
And the people endangering you would be protected by the cops, because you're the one upsetting them with your idea.
Yeah, their violence would be a cry of the oppressed, or something to that effect.
It seems good, at least, that's becoming more clear. I hope we see some trends against this insanity by that coming more to the forefront. You can see it in the recent pro-Hamas protests, and obviously I'm pro the Palestinian people having peace and flourishing, but you look at terrorist acts and people literally defending those, or having a rally within days of terrorist murder.
Right.
Saying go like the timing here. Like if there was a Catholic murder of Jews, for me to have any pro-Catholic rally the next day would be like, how about we sit this one out and apologize?
Oh yeah, it'd be unconscionable.
It would.
And again, that illustrates the idea that what's unconscionable for one group is very justified for another. So there's no elimination of the common principle.
Yeah, even if you're the victim, if you are inherently the oppressor,
right?
There is no victimhood.
Yeah.
Even if you're killed, you're still the oppressor, just being thrown off.
That's right. And I think that, as you indicate, that there is this sort of escalation is sort of waking people up. You see more and more people seeing through sort of what maybe was a manipulation tactic all along. Now that you see that a lot with Jewish people now, who are saying, wait, I've been marching in all your marches and supporting you, and now you've discarded your allies so easily.
Yeah.
I think we saw that with the feminists when the transgender movement moved past feminism. And they said, okay, we don't care now what a woman is any longer. Young women in high school locker rooms can have a fully intact male person naked watching them undress, and we're going to support that. And you see all these secular feminists say, wait, what happened? Why are you discarding us? But the revolution, the logic of a revolution keeps going. Mm. It was never about them anyway, and so they're easily discarded. Mm. But I think the movement tends to operate in three stages, three forms of manipulation, one by pity, next by fear, and then finally by force. And that force can be coercive laws, corrupt institutions, but ultimately the force turns violent. And I think we're starting to see that now, and that's when people start to wake up. It's kind of a scary time, but it's also a hopeful time, I think, because people start to see the other manipulations for what they were.
What are we supposed to do? When you wake up on the other side,
yeah.
when you become woke about what's going on, right? Like, what do you do about it? I mean, I've encountered a couple different audiences here as far as people who I want to respond to, like the kid who comes home from college, they're angry all of a sudden about everything they were raised with. There's people who are way in the woke thing and who are tactical and know what they're doing, right? And I've been attacked by these people online. There was one that was calling for people to either boycott my evangelistic events or show up protesting after I made a video on wokeism. And this woman said, you know, Chris is dangerous because that Chris attributes the civil rights movement entirely to French philosophers and French deconstructionists. And I said, well, hold on. Look at the video I made, because I literally say racial injustice is evil, systemic injustice is real, but that has been leveraged, the pain of injustice.
That's
and here's
right.
one of the awful things about wokeism. Mm-hmm. It leverages the pain of real injustice to push a movement of deconstructionism.
That's right.
It uses people and their pain again on a next level.
Exactly.
Ooh, how wicked is that? But I reached out and I explained all this. Right? And I said, I didn't say that. And also the point of language is to be able to express ideas. So you're giving me a chance to clarify. I'm clarifying to you, and I'm clarifying publicly. I don't think that.
Yeah.
The person's response was to ignore me and double down and then re-release her tweet as this big thread and to call people's attention to it. It's like, wait, I wasted my time talking to you because you use language as a tactic to pretend you're debating with me, not be open to anything I have to say in response. But your end goal was just to get me to shut up. It wasn't to dialogue. On the other side,
goal's not truth; it's power.
Yeah, that's it. They're acting out of their belief system. The other side is people who are good-willed people, who are genuinely like, I see injustice in the world. I want to do something.
That's right.
And what they're saying makes sense, or at least they want to fix what I'm seeing in front of me. How do you distinguish between those two, and how do you relate with each of those?
It's a great question, because I think it's so important. You know, we can't treat our sweet, woke Aunt Susan like she's our mortal enemy to vanquish.
Or anyone, right?
But nor can we, I think that we can just accompany a group of transgender story, you know, people who want to indoctrinate children into school. They are souls who should be befriended and should be respected and dignified people. But the movement has to be stopped still. So I think that there's a distinction, right? We don't need to know that there are things to stop, and but then there are people that are not objects of ideology. They are subjects who are our brothers or sisters. One of the distinctions I make, and I've used this analogy before, but I think it's helpful. There's a scene in that movie, The Sixth Sense. Mm. Haley Joel Osment, I See Dead People. Mm-hmm. He sees a young girl, his age, who has passed away. And she gives some evidence that her mother had this disturbing mental illness called Munchausen syndrome by proxy, where she was poisoning her food. Mm. It's a really disturbing mental illness.
Yeah, yeah.
And Haley Joel Osment presents the evidence to the father, and the father had no idea. And I think that's a good illustration. There are three characters in the story. There's the child, who's a total victim of this poison. Mm. Through no ill will or complicity of her own. There's the father, who is an unwitting participant. Mm. He's good-willed. He's trying to help, but he's accidentally bringing poison, thinking that it's food, just food. Mm. And then there's the mother, who, you know, hopefully she can be healed at some point, but she also needed to be stopped because the poison needed to be halted.
Yeah.
I think there's also a fourth character, which is maybe a nurse in the room who sort of knows something's wrong, but is too nervous to say anything or just doesn't want to get involved. And I think that's a good synopsis of different categories. It's a lot of us, yeah. That there really are some people who are true, total victims of this movement, who've been spoon-fed ideology, who have had their real wounds and sufferings exploited. And that's a lot of people, right? A lot of people coming out with deep wounds from, you know, brokenness, abuse, what have you, abandonment. And then the movement saying, take those wounds and help them to make you full of rage. And in that belligerence of your rage lies the revolution. And they become used in that way. And then there's a lot of goodwill people like the father who think they're helping. I know many people like this who are very progressive and just truly have a heart for people who have suffered and think this is the way to help them. And they need to be sort of enlightened, maybe, if they can be. So the victims need to be healed. The people who are unwitting participants need to be maybe helped to see things more clearly. And then there's the people who are, you know, more directly distributing the evil, and they, I think, need to be stopped and then hopefully can be healed and helped later. Mm. Maybe the nurse needs to be encouraged. So I think, you know, we have to tailor our tactics, basically, to the person in front of us, because they're not a representative of an ideology. They're their own unique human being who needs to be addressed personally.
What a beautifully Catholic way to approach that. This is all rooted in the person.
Yeah.
Right?
That's right.
And approach each person and give them the dignity of listening to them and trying to see where they're coming from.
That's right.
And God help us not close off to people. I mean, there's a spirit of cancel culture mm-hmm. that lacks mercy at all. There's no mercy. Right? If you're awake, then you're part of the club. And if you're not, you're less than human. In fact, this has become a leftist political language.
That's right. Yeah.
I mean leftist. That it's like those people aren't human.
That's right. There are massive excesses and obviously sins and a whole bunch of wrongs that people who are fighting against the woke movement engage in, including their own type of tribalism.
Right. Both sides are doing this. I heard a recent study that 80% of self-described conservatives hate what they say are liberals. 80% of liberals hate conservatives. There's an insanity here.
Yeah.
There's an insanity on both sides that Christian voices should just break out of and say, I'm refusing to go there. I'm going to see the person. I'm going to see the person. And that's a real struggle.
That's right. I think we have to fight the revolution and love people. And
right.
I think that loving people also means that we are fighting the revolution. But right. that can never switch into fighting the person.
Amen. Yeah, if we ourselves are looking for wokeism everywhere,
yeah.
then we have reduced our worldview, this reductionism, and the view of the other to an issue,
that's
to
right.
a power struggle. Literally, it's two sides of the same coin.
That's right. We approach the world with a hermeneutics of suspicion, which is what wokeism does, right? It wants you to find everywhere evil, racism, sexism, you know, ways to be offended.
And conservatives.
And we can do that ourselves.
Yeah, they look for wokeism everywhere.
Like, oh, who's a leftist? Who's a progressive?
And then dehumanize.
That's right.
You know, and there's the struggle of the human heart. The battle's right here. We wish it was out there. Identify the enemy. No, it's right here,
that's
man.
Right. Yep.
I'll never forget, I heard, was it Ted Kaczynski? The Oklahoma City bomber?
No, he was the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski.
Unabomber.
Yeah, yeah.
Hold on. I got it. The Unabomber. There it is. I had heard he went to confession before he died. And my first response was anger.
Huh.
And I brought that to prayer, and I just felt the Lord like saying, Chris, man, you know how hard I worked on Ted? Like,
wow.
Rejoice.
Wow.
I have to fight myself. You know, like, it's, especially as parents, you know, it's easy to fall into, like, your grandkid comes home hating you and hating the church.
Yeah.
Well, who is that professor?
Right.
Professor is the person that Jesus died for. God help us to be different. We can't do it without you.
Yeah. Amen. I know. That's the thing, is that because it is such a spiritual battle, it's really not a cultural battle or a political battle anywhere nearly it. Like, it's a spiritual battle.
Yeah.
And so if we are not drawing and arming ourselves so deeply close to Christ and arming ourselves in that way, we're not going to be effective in any way.
Mm.
You know, we can't give out what we don't receive. And it really has to be him that is going to change hearts, because it feels so daunting.
Amen.
To think about us doing it on our own.
You know what else is really important, and it's got to be driven by grace, is as we're talking, I'm just thinking, gosh, we got to do a better job at serving the poor.
Yeah.
You know, I think of what happened in Russia and how quickly it fell to communism. It fell to an ideology appealing to real injustice. But it became evil. It perpetrated a worse injustice, leveraging the pain of people. And I just wondered, gosh, if the church there were doing a better job than the Marxists at serving people in need, if they would have gotten away with spreading all those lies.
That's right. Which historically, the church has been at the forefront, right, of serving the poor through hospitals, orphanages, you know, all these things.
We got to lean in, and we also got to let people know, right?
Yeah.
I mean, as people want to overlook that fact.
Yeah.
But the average Catholic's, I think we got to, even though I think we're still doing better than most of the world, I mean, we're the largest social service provider on earth.
Right.
I think it's a time in history where let's lean in an even more heroic way to where the world can't overlook it.
Utterly agree.
Yeah.
And I think we also have to be the type of people who our friends aren't going to feel ashamed if they come to us and say, I think I'm rethinking all of this ideology, you know?
Mm.
I've had friends say that to me in the last couple of years as things have gotten so crazy. Friends who I thought were very leftist.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think we have to make sure that we are the type of people that they feel like they can say that to, and we're not going to spike a football on their heads.
I told you I was right.
Because of that polarization, it's really hard not to be like team-oriented.
Totally. Hey, thanks for going there.
Yeah.
Thanks for putting your neck out there, because I know you're taking hits just for talking about this. And I'll take hits for talking about this. And you know what? If you want to send some hits my way, I love you anyway. All right. So thanks for doing that. But also thanks for modeling how to do this with grace and with charity and without hatred for the other. May the Lord give us grace to stay in that space.
Praise God. Amen. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Noelle. Awake, not woke. Awake, not woke. And Theology,
yeah, Theology of Home book series.
Yeah. Where do they get the stuff?
Anywhere books are sold, through our website, theologyofhome.com, or our publisher, tanbooks.org, or the big booksellers, too.
Awesome. And be sure to like, subscribe, share this stuff with your friends. It's too good to keep yours to yourself. And we'll see you next time.
Guys, thank you so much for watching. Thanks for diving deep with us. Again, the culture war stuff isn't always the most pleasant stuff to look at. And I'm not going to get obsessed with that. And please join me in not becoming obsessed with all that stuff. But when it comes in the way of our big priority, which is living in freedom and loving people around us and sharing the joy and love of the gospel with them, if it becomes an obstacle to that because society's forming these walls between people and the gospel, we have to address it. So thanks for not being afraid to go there and to address it. And thanks for not being afraid to share this with people who might disagree. What? Yes, even those people, especially those people who you might be really afraid to share that with. This is my challenge for the week. Share this episode with that person. You on board? Cool. And be sure to go again to the show notes. reallifecatholic.com/marriage. Links in the show notes. We want to bless your marriage with simple videos that me and my wife produced, along with simple challenges that will make your marriage amazing in just 21 days. Love you guys. See you next time.